This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a pair of Appleton musicians have been working to share the music of Latin American composers with a wider audience. We'll learn about their project, Strings of Latin America. Now, many technology companies are turning their attention to the online virtual world known as the Metaverse. Just yesterday, Microsoft spent close to $70 billion to acquire the game developer Activision Blizzard, which it says will provide them with building blocks for the Metaverse. Walmart and Nike are among companies who have filed trademarks for their products in the virtual world. But the concept of the Metaverse is still loosely defined and foreign to most of us still here in the physical world. Our next guest teaches a class entirely in virtual reality, and he's here to help us understand the hype. Jeremy Bailenson is the Thomas More Stork Professor in the Department of Communication and founding director of the Virtual Human Interaction Lab at Stanford University. Jeremy, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
So people are hearing the word metaverse. Can you give them the elevator pitch on what exactly that means?
The metaverse is people, places, and things. People are avatars, representations of us as we see each other in a virtual world. Places are a persistent, meaning it's always there and it's always the same location where you can meet. And then things are objects, virtual versions of, could be shoes, could be houses, could be anything you could imagine. So loosely speaking, we think of the metaverse as virtual people, places, and things.
And the phrase metaverse comes from the Neal Stephenson novel, Snow Crash, I believe. I read it a long time ago. It was this flashy, super lit, super crowded place where I might have a samurai sword fight with somebody. What's the reality of our virtual reality online world right now?
Yeah, so the metaverse comes from science fiction, the term itself, and a lot of virtual reality, both on the technology side and on the research, we look to science fiction because these are the people who've been thinking about this for quite some time. But when you look to the world now, there's really three instantiations of the metaverse. Number one is you're wearing a VR headset and you are seeing other people's avatars and you're fully immersed. And when you think of those metaverse, there's places like VR Chat and Engage and Rec Room, and there's a couple thousand people per day on any one of those platforms at any given time. The second version are these 2D spaces similar to what we used to have in something called Second Life, where you use your mouse and your keyboard and you walk around VR. And a lot of these 2D spaces now, for example, Decentraland, they're being driven by NFTs, these crypto-based 3D objects, non-fungible tokens. A lot of the energy that you're seeing from these marketing companies, when you mentioned in the intro, for example, Nike, they're thinking about these 2D spaces. And then when you, of course, if you're expanding to 2D spaces, you have to think about places like Roblox that has 200 million monthly users, where you've got kids that are kind of playing around in their own metaverse. The third and final instantiation, which is very different from the first two, are those that do augmented reality. They want to map the planet. And so people that create these games, for example, Pokemon Go, you've got to create a version of the metaverse that maps geographically onto the physical world. So three different versions of the metaverse, all of them using that term, but very different in terms of their applications and the technology behind them.
With the virtual reality side of things, I've seen you quoted elsewhere talking about a lot of their potential right now being the world of work and of training. Can you talk about some of the potential that's becoming real now, not just potential?
So we like to joke, the original use case of virtual reality is from 1929. It was the flight simulator. And despite all the flashy things that you can think about VR to be used for, the one application that continues to endure and to be the true killer application is training. So I've co-founded a company called Striver. We began by training quarterbacks here at Stanford, then in the National Football League. Eventually, we moved to enterprise training companies. So we've trained over 800,000 Walmart employees who put on the goggles and then were instantly transported into Holiday Rush the day after Thanksgiving to learn how to handle the cacophony of all of those customers, or how to find a safety violation by looking around. We're now installing VR to 4,300 Bank of America across the country, where people will be able to train on how to talk to customers in a way that's better. And, you know, people talk about the metaverse, but what they often forget is you have to have a reason for somebody to go to VR. And why we like corporate training as the foundation for the metaverse is we know that it's a proven application, and everyday employees are spending time putting the goggles on. And we believe that as the metaverse gains traction, what's actually going to drive it is not going to be these fun marketing employees, but it's really going to be, you know, figuring out how to do your job better with training.
You've taught a class completely in virtual reality where everybody's wearing the goggles. You teach classes without it. What have you learned about when this is a useful tool and when it is not?
Thank you for that question. It's exactly the right one to be asking. And so we taught two classes in VR here at Stanford. We had 263 Stanford students over 6 months. They spent over 200,000 shared minutes together. This is minutes where they were in a room together, seeing each other's avatars in their own dorm rooms, wearing the headsets, but feeling like they're together. And some things work really well in VR. For example, if you're building something, you're designing a space, or if you want to have proper nonverbal communication. So on Zoom, if you are looking at a person on your screen, other people don't know where you're looking. But in VR, if you turn your head to look at a person, a third person in that room can see where you're looking. And if you point your finger at a fourth person, everyone can see the spatial coherence. They know where you're pointing. So where it was an epic win in our class using VR was, first of all, doing amazing things in VR, for example, building spaces. But second is really feeling this community of being together. We call it social presence.
We've talked about work training. We've talked about education. I'm a big nerd, Jeremy. How about entertainment? What is on the horizon there?
Well, the thing about entertainment is that it's not broken. So I always think about VR for, let's solve really hard problems. Like, how do you train someone on how to be in a very difficult situation? For example, if training firefighters that's a great use case because it's hard to do that. I don't like using VR gratuitously. And what works really well right now for your email is your phone or your computer. And what works really well for watching a movie is a screen. And so I'm not seeing the home run use cases that are purely entertainment based. And that's simply because entertainment is so good on 2D screens. It's unclear yet how 3D and having your body tracked in VR really adds to that.
Interesting. Jeremy, thanks so much for joining us today.
I really appreciate you having me and have a fantastic day there on Central.
You too. That's Jeremy Bailenson, the Thomas More Stork Professor in the Department of Communication at Stanford University, with us today to talk about virtual reality in the online world of the metaverse. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a journey to a Hmong New Year celebration.
Like many festivities, Hmong New Year celebrations were put on hold in the first year of the pandemic. Some gatherings returned this last year, including a New Year celebration at Sheboygan North High School. As we continue to settle into 2022, Gong Sue Xiong brings us the sounds and voices from that event.
I sat in the gym and watched as the opening dancers began their performance. People were quickly snapping their grand entrance photos before pouring in to join the main event.
Hmong New Year is a time to celebrate, gather family and friends together, make new friends, and find soulmates.
Sheila Ya is the co-chair for Hmong Mutual Assistance Association, the organization in charge of hosting this year's Hmong New Year in Sheboygan.
I think COVID played a role that gave a lot of individuals, families, friends, and the community a different perspective. It gave them a way to see a different way of life, that gathering means something to you. So this year, it brought out everyone back to spend time with each other.
The lobby is also full of people. There are people waiting in line for Hmong food. The menu consists of rice, chicken, papaya salad, and so much more. And there's an even longer line of people ordering bubble tea. There are vendors selling fruits and vegetables, clothing and jewelry, and other merchandise. Fashion is very important in the Hmong culture. Most people today are dressed in a jacket with embroidered textile, a white pleated skirt or black pants wrapped under a waistband, and of course, the entire outfit is adorned with beads and jewelry. You hear that jingling sound? That's the sound of coins. Silver coins are also a big part of traditional Hmong clothes. Historically, these coins represented wealth.
Everyone is dressed up in beautiful outfits.
Meng Xiong is a sponsor from the Wisconsin United Coalition of Mutual Assistance Association.
You know, I love the Hmong New Year. I grew up going to it every year. We get to showcase talent with dance, singing.
Bei Jiu Long Gao Hmong. Bei Jiu Long Gao Hmong means our young Hmong woman.
And the pageants.
The best performers win a trophy and up to $1,000 in prize money, which they often use to cover travel and clothing expenses. The hallway next to the stage and audience is bustling with dancers preparing for their performances.
When I did perform after COVID-19, it was just really exciting.
Pamela Va is a dancer from the dance team Ling Mom Hong, which in English translates to Hong Sisters.
I know a lot of dance teams they had a lot of ideas, even more ideas throughout the pandemic, and they have become a lot more creative. You're just ready to come out and show everyone what you got.
Take these opportunities to come join us. I would say challenge yourself to immerse yourself in another person's culture. We have a lot in common. You just grow so much as a person when you open your heart and your mind to other cultures. So come join us.
Gong Suo Xiong brought us that story on a Hmong New Year celebration in Sheboygan. She's a student at UW Milwaukee. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast and find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, the Strings of Latin America Project is raising the profile of composers and making their music more widely available. We'll talk to the two Appleton musicians behind it. That's next year on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. In the conversations we have about representation and diversity, one area that might not immediately come to mind is classical music. Our next guests are 3 years into a project with ties to Lawrence University in Appleton that's trying to change that. They say there's a lack of access to music composed by people who aren't white Europeans and Americans, and that's a big problem for musicians and composers. Natalie Herrera Pacheco is director of research for the Strings of Latin America initiative and research and intern coordinator for Lawrence University and the Sphinx Organization. Natalie, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. It's so nice to be here with you.
And Horacio Contreras is artistic director for the project and associate professor of music at Lawrence University. Horacio, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Horacio, let's start with you. Can you tell us how the Strings of Latin America project got started?
Yeah, of course. This project is the result of an initial research made by Venezuelan cellist Germán Marcano, who is a very good friend of mine, who started in the early 2000s researching music from Latin America for cello. He back then published a catalog of music for that instrument in the form of a book, but there was a small number of books printed in that time. And I always admired that book. I used it a lot. And in 2017, I spoke with Germán and came up with the idea of making this resource available for a larger number of people through an online platform. That's when I also spoke with Aaron and Afa Dworkin from the Sphinx organization, and they were gladly interested in the project, and that's where everything started. We published the first catalog there in 2018, and then this has been growing since then.
Natalie, can you talk about the work you do, the research you do, including with the students from Lawrence University, to try to find and collect this music?
Sure. Well, I'll say a little bit more about the project.
Sure.
Once the Sphinx cello catalog was published, we started seeing that our project was already involving other tasks. So those tasks were also attracting other people from the music community. So that's when we decided to create our own initiative, which is Strings of Latin America. And there we do research on Latin American music written for strings. We also do catalog materials, and we are constantly updating the catalogs. Right now we have the cello catalog, but also the viola catalog. We write biographies for Latin American composers. We create educational videos and presentations in order to show the music heritage from Latin America.
Well, let's hear. Go ahead.
Yeah, and with all these new tasks we have this internship program, and this happened through our partnership with Lawrence University and the Sphinx Organization. We offer students from Lawrence and from several institutions around the country the opportunity to join us in our effort to research projects and learn at the same time the challenges and the rewards of working with this wonderful and sadly unrepresented music.
Well, I want to hear some of the music, of course. And Natalie, can you start us off by telling us about the first bit we're going to hear? This is from the first movement of the Concerto for Cello and Orchestra by Ricardo Castro. Can you tell us a bit about it before we listen?
Sure. This is a very interesting piece. Ricardo Castro was a Mexican composer, and he was active at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th. And this is the first cello concerto written in Latin America. And that's an important document, of course, for the history of this instrument. And he composed that, we believe, in at the beginning of the 20th century. It was premiered by Lovenson in Paris. And the concerto chose a romantic style. You will hear like very clear that, probably influenced by the cello concerto written by Camille Saint-Saëns. And that's the cello concerto by Ricardo Castro.
Here's a listen. Excerpt from Ricardo Castro's Concerto for Cello and Orchestra. We're talking about the Strings of Latin America project associated with Lawrence University. Horacio, could you set up our next piece now? Ricardo Lorenz, his piece Cecilia in Blue and Green, some of the third movement called Green. Can you tell us about it first?
Of course. Ricardo Lorenz is a Venezuelan-American composer born in 1960. He is the head of the composition department at Michigan State University and a very good friend of mine. And this piece was commissioned by Mexican cellist Carlos Prieto, and is inspired by Ricardo's mother, Cecilia Abreu. The piece has three movements, Blue, Cadenza, and Green. And Green has a lot of influence from the music of the Caribbean.
All right, here's a listen to this composition by Ricardo Lorenz. Cecilia in Blue and Green, our technical director's rocking out to this one. Horacio, I understand you know the cellist very well on this one.
Yeah, I know him very well. I actually was born with him because the cellist is me.
Well, and that brings me to my big question here, Natalie. Can you talk about, obviously the hope of this in part is that musicians now and in the future can perform these songs, right?
We are very happy because we will have our first edition from the Ricardo Castro's concerto very soon out and available for people. And this is so exciting.
Yeah, it is very exciting. We're really working very hard for people to get to know this music and for them to have access also to information about the composers and hopefully in the very near future to scores that we will be producing.
And Horacio, are you seeing people already use the catalogs, both the ones that were before your project and now what you're assembling? Is this getting used by people in their performances now?
Yeah, I get emails all the time asking me about works, about information. And I actually have a very, very sweet anecdote of a student, of a high school student that approached me in an event that I held in South Carolina for a large number of students there. He came to me and he asked me if I was the author of the Sphinx catalog. And then he thanked me because through the catalog, he was able to find a piece that he was practicing at that moment and that he really loved. So that was very sweet to learn from this high school student from South Carolina.
And Natalie, in our last few moments, how exciting is it when you are able to get your hands on this music and know you are keeping it around, keeping that musical heritage alive?
Well, in a very personal level, it's very important because it's also a way to be at home. It's a way to build bridges between being here in Wisconsin and looking to the south and see that this music is here, that can be here and can be available for other people, and that can help to create those bridges between this society and our societies there.
That's a good place to leave it. Natalie, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
And Horacio, thanks for being with us.
It was wonderful. Thank you so much for having us.
I've been talking to Natalie Herrero-Pacheco, Director of Research for the Strings of Latin America Initiative, and Horacio Contreras, Associate Professor of Music at Lawrence University, the group's Artistic Director. We talked to him today about their work to research and catalog and then share information and music from Latin American composers with the hope of preserving them and having people perform them. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, alcohol-related deaths have been on the way up in Wisconsin over the last 20 years, and the pandemic didn't help. We'll check out a report on the rising toll of alcohol in the state and look at some possible solutions. Plus, college enrollment is down over the last couple of years, with community colleges among the hardest hit. We'll find out why and how those colleges are responding, that and more, tomorrow here on Central Time. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, and then we'll take a closer look at who remains unvaccinated in the United States and an effort showing some signs of success at boosting vaccinations here in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a proposal in the Wisconsin Assembly would lower the age for concealed carry of firearms from 21 to 18. We'll talk to the sponsor of the bill and then to a gun policy expert on regulations for younger gun owners. First, the State Department of Health Services says about 59% of Wisconsinites have gotten fully vaccinated against COVID-19. But the pace of vaccinations has slowed down a lot over the last few months. With cases surging again in the state and hospitals short-staffed, public health officials are continuing to make the case for getting vaccinated. A recent effort by Marshfield Clinic Health System in central and northern Wisconsin is showing some signs of success. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you talked to loved ones in your own life about getting vaccinated? Have you noticed a message or a strategy that's persuasive? If you are a healthcare worker, what kind of conversations do you have with the patients you work with? Do you see high or low vaccination rates in your own community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Miranda Egebrecht is Director of Care Management and Value-Based Care with Marshfield Clinic Health System. Miranda, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
What made Marshfield Clinic want to take on this effort of trying to reach out to people who hadn't gotten vaccinated or at least not yet?
Yeah, well, first, we learned very early in the pandemic that individuals really want information. They want to know what's going on. They want accurate data so that they can make informed decisions. And so we wanted to be part of that conversation. We know historically that people value their opinions, thoughts, and background that healthcare providers can give. And so that was really one of our motivating factors of us reaching out to our patients and communities to be able to provide that accurate information so, again, they can make the best informed decision for them.
You serve a lot of rural communities, and just looking at county maps of Wisconsin, rural counties, many of them anyway, have lower vaccination rates. Was that a particular focus of your outreach effort?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as you mentioned earlier, when we look at the state data, we know that there's still work to be done in terms of vaccination. But in particular, our service area for Marshfield Clinic Health System does include a few counties with some of the lowest rates in the state. And so we, again, wanted to be that resource to provide that information and education where we're needed to answer questions or concerns that folks had so that we can really improve the health of communities. The more people we can get vaccinated, the better protected the communities are.
So can you talk about specifically what kind of outreach you did to your Marshfield Clinic patients?
Yeah, so with our campaign, we had a couple different arms. So first, we knew, again, that we needed to be mindful of how we delivered messages. So in particular, making sure that we had media materials that were available in English, Hmong, and Spanish, and a variety of media materials. So billboards, social media, streaming services. So that, again, the more that was out there, hopefully the more individuals could receive that information. And again, in the language that they prefer. We also did an email campaign. So again, as a way for our own patients, we could really directly communicate with them and share those resources, share the recommendations from our healthcare providers directly, and then again, provide any further resources to them so that they could continue to explore and have those trusted resources available at their fingertips.
We're talking about COVID-19 vaccination outreach. Miranda Egebrecht is with us from Marshfield Clinic Health System, Director of Care Management and Value-Based Care there, looking at efforts to talk to people who aren't vaccinated, answer their questions, get them information. You can join in with your thoughts, maybe your experiences at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Mike is with us in Milwaukee. Mike, hi.
Hi. I think we're past information, the information stage. There's been information going on 2 years almost now that we've had vaccinations and information. And information isn't the problem or lack of information. It's the fact that people don't believe the information. This has turned into a political football. You have one political party that is disparaging vaccinations and efforts for people to wear masks. You have a news channels and these right-wing channels like Fox News that is disparaging vaccinations. It's become such a political football. It's like it's past conversation. It's ingrained right now. You're not going to change people's thinking because all the information you give them, they're not going to believe it anyways. It's fake news.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Miranda, I wanted to ask you about the results of reaching out to people in the conversations you've had. Mike might be right about some people, but it sounds like in some cases people did decide to get vaccinated.
Yeah, certainly when we talk about vaccine readiness, we see the continuum, right? We see people who have made up their minds on both ends of the spectrum, but certainly there are a lot of people who still really want that one-on-one conversation so that they can really dig into some of the questions that they may have. And that's where I feel, you know, our providers are ready. They're willing to have that conversation, really ready to understand and see, you know, where people are coming from and understand what they may be thinking and help to provide information that would be valuable for them. Within some of our outreach campaigns, within 2021, we were able to provide over 175,000 COVID vaccines, again, among many of our vulnerable populations. And again, we were able to open those doors up and have many conversations in our office setting and in our communities about, you know, those specific questions, specific concerns that individuals have so that, again, they can see the big scope and make those decisions for themselves.
What were some of the most common questions or concerns that people had that were addressed in this email campaign or maybe in one-on-one conversations with a healthcare provider?
Yeah, so, you know, again, we see a variety of questions. Some of them are specific to where people may be at in their life. So women who are in childbearing years may have different questions or concerns compared to older male counterparts, or parents now of younger children may have more specific concerns. So, you know, a lot of questions around the safety of the vaccines, how we were able to have a vaccine so quickly, the long-term side effects. Those were a lot of those repeat questions or concerns that we had that we were able to, again, have some conversations with, put together some information, some handouts, put together PSAs, and then again, point others to CDC, to the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, and other reliable resources.
How much of a concern has access been? I know at various stages, that's been one reason that people have cited for not getting vaccinations. They know that vaccines are out there, but it might involve taking time off work that they don't have, or getting transportation or childcare, or, you know, the list goes on and on. How big a part of the story is that?
Sure. Very early on, you're right. We did see that was a challenge for many. We needed to work with the supply that we had. We needed to work with other community vaccinators to make sure that we could see the scope and what was accessible. Now it's more easily accessible. We have a greater supply. We have that on hand. We have some easy access in terms of online self-scheduling that's available to patients. We have some walk-in clinics available to individuals. We try and make sure that we have hours available outside of those regular business hours. So again, when you talk about work or school and the ability to get there at a time that works well, we do have that variety. So hopefully that access has improved for others, and we continue to listen. So, you know, what is it that individuals need in terms of that access, making it readily available at existing appointments, for example, or being somewhere else that's more maybe available and open in the community.
We've heard concerns in Wisconsin and elsewhere during this Omicron surge that healthcare providers, hospitals in particular, again, getting overwhelmed with an increase in COVID-19 cases. What kind of things are you hearing around Marshfield Clinic providers?
Yeah, absolutely. So like everybody else, we've been in this now for almost 2 years. And so we're tired. We're all ready to be out of the pandemic. But we continue to work hard to be mindful of what we need in terms of providing care when individuals need that hospitalization. We're trying to be mindful of what can we do to prevent that hospitalization from happening. We're working hard to make sure, again, that we continue to stress the importance of masking, of vaccination. We're working hard to make sure that we're providing the testing resource that's available for individuals so that they can, again, make decisions sooner. So every step along the way, when we talk about prevention all the way up into the needs that individuals may have in terms of hospitalization, we're working around the clock, making sure that we're doing everything that we can. But certainly we know that this has been very stressful. And this surge is, you know, again, another surge in this 2-year-long stretch. And so we're asking individuals to continue to do your part, continue to mask if you haven't been vaccinated, get the vaccine, get the booster if you're able to. We're in this together, but we need to continue to take some steps moving forward.
Miranda, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Miranda Egebrecht. She's Director of Care Management and Value-Based Care with Marshfield Clinic Health System. She was with us today to talk about Marshfield Clinic's email campaign and conversation campaign with patients that it says drove about 100,000 vaccinations. Up next, we'll continue the conversation. A journalist joins us who spent time talking to Americans who are vaccine hesitant and those who opposed the vaccine. She'll tell us more about the wide range of attitudes and beliefs. It's not necessarily all or nothing for a lot of people. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Were you on the fence with getting the COVID-19 at some point? What pushed you one way or another? Or has that not happened yet? Do you have conversations with people in your life about whether or not they should get vaccinated? What sort of concerns do you hear from them? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation about Americans who are unvaccinated against the virus that causes COVID-19, what's leading to hesitancy for some people. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on the topic, your experiences, maybe what kind of decision-making process you might have gone through before getting vaccinated, or if you're having conversations with others, if you work in healthcare, maybe conversations with your patients. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Julie Bosman joins us now. She's the Chicago Bureau Chief for the New York Times. She's profiled a number of unvaccinated Americans last summer in a piece titled, "Who Are the Unvaccinated in America? There's No One Answer." Julie, welcome back to Wisconsin and to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
What led you and your colleagues to try to take a closer look on the reasons people gave for holding off on getting vaccines?
Well, I think that the stories that we've written about unvaccinated Americans have come from trying to answer a really simple question. Who are the unvaccinated? What are their reasons? You know, what are they thinking? What are their motivations? And one thing that I have discovered over and over again when writing these articles is just that there are really complicated reasons for why people have chosen not to be vaccinated. And this is not one big monolithic group. This is not necessarily a group of people who are, you know, anti-vaxxers in the way that they've been portrayed in some corners of the media. Some people just have really complicated personal reasons for not getting vaccinated. And a lot of people in this big group of Americans is still kind of willing to be persuaded under the right circumstances.
That's what really struck me reading your piece. I think it's sometimes easy in the media or watching or listening to the media to say there's two groups. You know, one group enthusiastically got the vaccines as soon as they were eligible. Another is dug in and will never, ever, ever do it. there's a lot of middle ground there.
Absolutely. I mean, I found this in my own life that, you know, the cousins, friends, people who are not vaccinated, you know, they have reasons that, you know, sometimes they even have trouble articulating, or they have emotional reasons. They may have heard of a friend who had a bad reaction to a vaccine, and that was enough to scare them away. So there's a lot of power in the personal anecdote. And I think that examples like that just show how tough it is to understand, you know, who this group of people is and how to persuade them. If you're a public health official, you're trying to convince people to get vaccinated so that the pandemic can finally, you know, start to wane at last. And I think that's what has made this such a big challenge for public health officials.
You started to touch on this. Can you share a couple more of the personal stories that you and your colleagues heard from people as to why they weren't against vaccination, but weren't ready to get it quite yet at the point you talked to them?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, some people just, you know, they worried about the time span. They said, look, these vaccines were produced really quickly. I'm just going to wait and see. So there were plenty of people in that wait and see group. Now, of course, we are a year into vaccine availability in the United States. So I think the wait and see group is probably diminishing at this point. You know, some people just said, you know, I stood outside of a vaccine clinic in Chicago one day last summer and just talked to everybody who was going in. And I talked to one man who was in his 70s and just said, look, I was a little worried. I feel like I'm really healthy. I don't think I need this, but I wanted to visit a friend who is a lot older than me and she's in fragile health. So I didn't think it would be responsible to do that if I was unvaccinated. So here I am. So sometimes it just comes down to a really specific set of circumstances. There are a lot of people who said that they were doing it because they were getting ready to go to school in the fall, or their college required it, or their, you know, work required it, their employer required it. So a lot of people have been swayed by mandates as they have come and gone.
Talking to Julie Bosman from the New York Times, Chicago bureau chief there, talking about unvaccinated Americans, vaccine hesitancy when it comes to the COVID-19 vaccinations. And it's not all or nothing. It's not yes or no. There's a lot of maybe out there. You could join in with your thoughts, maybe your experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring out a caller now. Jeff is with us in Wausau. Jeff, hi.
Hi, Rob. Just glad to say that I've got the vaccine. I believe in modern science. I believe in good old-fashioned journalism, and I believe in both of you. Thanks for inviting us all along on this information journey. anyway, I'm wondering if anybody speculated on the numbers. If nobody took another booster, if nobody took another vaccine, what's the absolute worst-case scenario for fatalities and long-term illness? Thank you for taking my question.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Julie, I'm not sure if that's the sort of numbers you have researched or reported on yourself, but it seems like the data from hospitals is showing pretty clearly the more people who get vaccinated, the fewer people end up with serious problems in the hospital.
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't think I have the precise numbers on that, but I can say that one number that really hasn't budged very much in the last few months is the percentage of Americans who are fully vaccinated, and that's still around 63%. Now that includes children who are younger than 5 who are not eligible yet for the vaccine. But in terms of hospitalization, severe illness, death, I've talked to many emergency room doctors, many physicians, nurses who have said when they look at their hospitals right now, when they look at their ICUs, when they see who's in the COVID units, it is the majority of those patients are unvaccinated, and the patients who are vaccinated are generally not boosted. So it's a pretty consistent finding across a lot of hospitals in the United States that if you are boosted, you are almost certainly not going to end up severely ill or dying from this infection, which is the point of vaccination. You know, we've certainly found out that Omicron, the Omicron variant, is spreading among fully vaccinated and boosted people, but most of those people are not getting severely ill. So that's the goal of the vaccines.
And the New York Times has done polling on why hesitant people don't want to get vaccinated. I know you've been following the issue since that initial report that you did that we talked about earlier. Have things changed when it comes to why people aren't getting vaccinated, or have the people who are on the fence maybe by now made up their mind one way or the other?
Well, one thing that has shifted things slightly is the Omicron variant, that about half of vaccinated adults who are not boosted say that the Omicron variant makes them more likely to get that booster. It hasn't changed many minds among unvaccinated adults. The latest numbers that I saw from a health organization is that among unvaccinated adults, only about 12% of them said that they were more likely to get the COVID vaccine because of the Omicron variant. So there's certainly a lot of people who are really dug in at this point and are not willing to change their minds.
Let's round one more caller. Christopher is with us in Elkhorn. Christopher, hi.
Hello. I was just calling to state some, you know, what I've observed about, you know, most people in my personal life about why they choose not to get the vaccine, and usually always revolves around, you know, not trusting what, you know, the media says, or not understanding, you know, the specifics about like mRNA, or, you know, just generally not understanding the science behind it. And I was curious if, you know, either of you are aware of any plans or programs that are being talked about with, you know, trying to, you know, help with educating the general community about, you know, helping to make the right choice.
Christopher, thanks for that call. Julie, just before we talked to you, we heard from Marshfield Clinic here in Madison, who's trying to do just that, using the contacts between doctors and their patients. Do we see that happening elsewhere? Do we know if that is a more successful approach with the public that in some cases might not trust any big scale institution?
Yeah, I mean, I think that raises such a good point. Like, who are the trusted figures, you know, who it's, we've certainly seen in the last 2 years that local public health directors, state public health directors have been harassed by some people. They've been accused of lying, of spreading mistruths, when really these are people who are just trying to, you know, give information to the public. They're trying to communicate what the CDC is saying. One thing that I've heard just in my reporting is that people are much more likely to listen to their own doctor or their own nurse if they have a relationship with, you know, a physician or a trusted healthcare worker. Then they're much more likely to listen to that person. But there are so many people in this country who do not have a primary care doctor, who don't have someone who they can go to regularly. So that's something that, you know, is something that happened before the pandemic, that people just don't have a relationship with a doctor. That's becoming a really acute problem now that we're in a pandemic.
Julie, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Julie Bosman, Chicago Bureau Chief for the New York Times, with us today to talk about her profile last summer of unvaccinated Americans. Earlier, we talked to Miranda Egebrecht of Marshfield Clinic about an email campaign they say helped drive 100,000 vaccinations. Coming up, we talk with the sponsor of a proposal that would lower the minimum age for concealed carry in Wisconsin from 21 to 18. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.